Welcome to Keep Calm and Cook On. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. Each episode of Keep Calm and Cook On features a meaningful interview and answers to listeners' questions about cooking. Thank you to OXO for making this episode possible. OXO makes many of the kitchen tools that I trust the most. To find out more about OXO and their products, head over to OXO.com. That's OXO.com. Today is the final episode of the first season of Keep Calm and Cook On, and I'm so delighted to close the season with my guest, Liz Alpern. Liz is passionate about bringing people together through food. She's the creator of Queer Soup Night, which is honestly the regular party I wish I had in my life when I was younger. At each gathering of Queer Soup Night, there's a big pot of soup and a ton of great people who come together to have a bowl and raise some money for a community organization. Each Queer Soup Night is joyful. Each is a time to feel welcome, for people, myself included, who identify as queer, to not feel like an exception in the room. There are now Queer Soup Night communities across the country. Liz is also the co-founder of the Gefilteria and the co-author of the Gefilte Manifesto, New Recipes for Old World Jewish Foods. Liz and her co-founder Jeffrey's mission for their work is to reclaim and revolutionize Ashkenazi cuisine. Through their book, classes, consulting, and even through the gefilte fish that they manufacture, the Gefilteria celebrates and preserves the best of Ashkenazi home and storefront cuisine. In all of her free time, Liz is also a faculty member at the International Culinary Center's Culinary Entrepreneurship Program, and she consults for the national food justice organization, the Fair Food Network. In general, but in particular as a gay Jewish woman who works toward food justice, I'm so thrilled to have had a chance to talk to Liz about the work she does and the intention she brings to it. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Will you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Liz Alpern, and I am so many things. I am the creator of Queer Soup Night and the co-owner of the Gefilteria, which is a company that is focused on reimagining old world Jewish food. And I am the co-author of a cookbook called The Gefilte Manifesto, New Recipes for Old World Jewish Foods. And, you know, get into a lot of other stuff too.
Awesome. I was wondering, how do you file your taxes? Like, what do you say you do on that form? Because you do so many things.
It's such a good question. I think the last 2 years I've filed as a writer because it made writing a book less complicated in terms of that income. I don't know if you've experienced that.
That is what I put, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure that, you know, it was writer or consultant in the last few. I know I did writer for a couple of years, but yeah, it's a great
question.
I feel
like consultant is like the most vague. If I ever meet someone who's a consultant, I'm like, that. Who even knows?
Although I actually went to business school. I have my MBA, and I learned that there's an entire world of people who get paid a lot of money to be consultants, and that's awesome.
Yeah, we have to get into that. I want to talk mostly about the two things you mentioned, Queer Soup Night and Gefilteria.
Awesome.
So Queer Soup Night, it was born out of the 2016 election, is that right?
Yes.
Tell me about those early days.
Well, there is a precursor to it, which is that I have always wanted to have a queer soup party because I love soup. I've always loved soup. You can ask my mom that I would like make her pack me a thermos of soup to school. Like, I've never liked sandwiches. I've always wanted a hot lunch. I've always wanted soup. It's like a joke in the family that I always wanted soup.
Types of soup? Any particular?
Honestly, I'm not that discriminatory when it comes to soup. You know, I go in phases, but you know, my favorite is the category of what I call broth with stuff in it. So, like a really good broth, and then there's like stuff in it. But no, because you have like your blended soups.
Sure, not a puree.
Which are lower on my rung of favorite soups. I would say there's also stews, which I love. But, you know, there's definitely seasonal and like very meat oriented, which sometimes you just don't want to eat meat, you know? I try not to eat too much meat.
Chili territory.
Yeah. Yes. But I still, there's thicker soups that have a lot of stuff in it, where you're not like spooning broth, you're spooning stuff. And that's what I would put in the like stew-ish category.
I feel like I should tell you that when I was finishing up college, having studied poetry and knowing I was into food, not getting an MBA, and sort of curious about how I might make money in this world, I had this whole plan that I was going to start a soup business. And I was like super into it. Super into it. So yeah, I'm with you. I'm just nodding to all the different categories. Yes, and I am with you. Yes. I'm so with you. So you've always loved soup.
Always loved soup. Always had this idea. Not always. I have no idea when the idea started, but have long held a vision of this soup pop-up where it's kind of like sexy queer women serving soup. And but I could not figure out a way to make money on this idea. And so this idea sort of became an idea on the shelf. And in came the 2016 election and this sort of compulsion to feel helpless and what are we going to do? And everybody around you sort of getting really involved. And I was going to whatever meetings, you know, was invited to and trying to figure out, well, where's my place in all of this? And, you know, side note, I still laugh when I tell this story because it's like, why did it take this election to get me to care about all this stuff? And I feel a lot of trouble in my heart about that. But I think a lot of people feel that way. And so I'm with you. So after the election, feeling like we should be doing something and realizing that this soup idea could actually be a fundraiser. And there were many people that helped make that connection. It was not just me alone. Lots of other people had said, you know, like maybe we do a fundraiser. Let's think about it. And basically was given this opportunity to have a space and by this coffee shop that I used to go to a lot and actually probably wrote like half my cookbook in, and was offered that space. And we threw the first queer soup night. And
who's the we? Who are these other
it's
folks?
It's kind of, you know, I mean, right now, the two people that I work with on it the most are my friends Kathleen Cunningham and Jennifer Martin. And they're sort of the other two people very, very much on the core team of Queer Soup Night. They were definitely there in the beginning, but tons of other friends were involved and had volunteered to come help out. So it was kind of like our group of friends, which was like
community
an extended
effort. Yeah.
Yeah. Like everybody just chipped in. You know, my friend Des made a flyer in 1 second because we realized, oh, we need a flyer, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, a bunch of people came over to help me cook the actual soup. So in the beginning, I made all the soup and the bread. Somebody else, I think, like picked me up in their car and drove me the like 5 blocks. So and everybody helped serve it. I mean, my friend David, who is sort of our Queer Soup Night kitchen manager, he came and he like ran back of the house for this event. And back of the house is also front of the house for this event. So, you know, everybody chipped in. And first of all, everybody that was there in the beginning is pretty much still around, like majorly in Queer Soup Night, which I feel like is a good sign of what the party is. But we kind of all just threw down and everybody invited their friends. And it was mostly people we knew or somehow we knew how we knew them, you know, one step removed. We just kind of like threw it on Instagram. And I think I'd say that the first one, something like 60 to 70 people showed up, which was pretty cool.
Did you prepare enough soup?
I did. And in the beginning, we used to have leftover soup. We do not have any leftover
soup
now.
That doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah, no.
What did you do with the leftover soup? You just continued to enjoy it?
Filling up quart containers and everybody going home with soup. I remember freezing a ton of the extra broth I had made and eating it for a long time.
So it continued to feed you.
Yes. Yes. Everybody went home with – anybody who wanted to definitely went home with quart containers of soup.
And so now, more than 2 years later, how many people usually come to a queer soup night?
Well, what we've done now is we do smaller events and we do larger events because the party kept growing to the point where we could no longer have it in a coffee shop and then we could no longer have it in the first bar that we moved it to. And so now we have it in an actual venue when we have our main events. And so we'll get somewhere around 250, maybe 300 people showing up.
That's a lot.
It's a lot of people. It is. I just checked the RSVPs for our next event. We have 215 people RSVP'd and I'm kind of like, who are all these people? It's amazing. It's amazing.
So it's grown past that sort of initial community where you either knew everyone or kind of knew how you knew them.
Definitely. Yeah. And that started to happen basically by the second party.
Wow.
And that was when we realized we were onto something, mm-hmm. I think. Because the first one, it felt amazing to feel like our core group of people could raise, I think we raised $750 or something. And it was like, what? We didn't know that we could do this. But now it feels like, I mean, we've raised almost $25,000 since we've started this party.
That's amazing.
And I have to correct that number. It's yeah. not. It's we're going to correct this. It's more like $22,000. Uh-huh. Fine. You know, I don't want to fake news, you guys.
What would the consultant say?
But, and that is made up of $10, $20 donations from random queers, most of whom I don't even know. I mean, it's amazing.
And so I feel like I jumped ahead asking you that. Can you tell me, tell all of us, the mission of Queer Soup Night and sort of that kind of fundraising aspect of it and how that's kind of, you know, just built into the structure of the evening?
Yeah. So at each party, we have a couple of different chefs making soup. So somewhere between 2 and 4 and 5 chefs making different soups. Sometimes I make a soup, sometimes I don't now. There's a lot of other things to do. So when folks show up, they donate at the door. Suggested donation is $10 to $20, but you don't have to. And basically, once you're in, you can have as much soup as you want. And we've announced ahead the organization we're raising funds for. So each event raises funds for a different organization, and we donate 100% of the proceeds to that organization. So once the night is over and we've paid back our chefs for their ingredients, or, you know, we've paid back the venue, what we owe them, or, you know, whatever other costs are incurred, we basically hand all the rest of it over to the organization that we've raised funds for.
And so in the past 2 years, that's added up to...
Yeah,
somewhere like between $20,000 and $25,000. That's amazing.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
It's crazy.
Can I ask just logistically, how much it costs to produce an actual event, like the ingredients, the bowls, the cleanup, the, you know, whatever the other costs are?
It varies. Mm-hmm. So if we are at a venue that we have to pay, the cost goes up a lot more.
Sure.
And we have been given a pretty good deal for the one venue we do pay for. But what I will tell you is in New York, there's just only so many venues that are out there that want to do something like this. And once you get above 200 people, there really aren't any bars that hold you. So you have to get a venue, you know. But I would say for an event that we don't have to pay for the venue, which is like one of our smaller events, it's probably somewhere like $600.
So not astronomical.
Oh, no. But we're also super scrappy. And, you know, I drive my own car there, and we, you know, I own burners because I work in food. So, you know, everybody sort of contributes. But we pay back every chef, and we have the bowls and the whatever. Yeah,
it's cheap. It's like the literal stone soup. Everyone throws something in.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Seriously.
You started it 2016. You had
it was
that
27. It was 2017. January 2017.
Yeah. You had that initial kind of group. Would you say the dynamics of who attends? I know it's the number is larger, but the people who are coming, has that sort of changed over time? Or are you seeing different types of people come, you know, different ages or backgrounds or anything like that?
It's an interesting question. One observation I actually have is that we have over time gotten more younger people to come, which is cool because in the beginning, I think this party immediately spoke to the, you know, 30s and early 40s set of queers in New York who really loved the idea of going to a party but did not want to go to a party at 11 p.m. on a Saturday night. And we're like, Sunday at 6 sounds ideal.
I'm
just nodding my head. I'm like, in bed by 8, you know? I mean, people would say that to us. They were like, literally, this is the best time you could possibly throw a party. Thank you. And I think because the party's grown and is like kind of cool, theoretically, we get more of the younger, like party 20-something crowd. And those are people that I don't know, right? So those are the people that are not in my necessarily in my sphere of like my friends and my friends of friends. Like a 23-year-old, like I don't have as many points of contact with a 23-year-old, but now I do feel like we get more folks in that category, which I really think is so much fun because when I was in my 20s, I would have loved to go to this party.
Yeah. You're describing and my sort of brief experience getting to be part of a kind of a queer soup night, the whole time I just kept thinking if I had been able to go to this when I was, yeah, exactly, 21, 22, I think things would feel really different. What do you describe the feeling in the room, and what do you hope people walk away feeling? Full.
Yeah, definitely. You know, one of our, we have like a few things that really matter to us, and one of them is an atmosphere of welcome. Queer events can feel really clicky. And I can't say, oh, Queer Soup Night's not clicky. I can't make that promise. I can't make that claim. But what I can say is we are intentional about making moves that make it feel less clicky and more welcoming.
What do those moves look like?
We always have someone or two people who are greeting people even as they're coming in. Like if there's a line outside, we'll have somebody on the line like letting folks know what's going on inside. Like, hey, you'll be in a few. Thanks for coming. Here's what happens when you get inside. I think we've all rolled up to a party and you're sort of waiting online and you're wondering, am I ever going to even get inside? Like what's happening? I don't know. And so we try to even make from the second you're sort of like about to walk in the door that someone is there just sort of telling you that you're welcome. Yeah, and acknowledging your presence. We have greeters. Kathleen is our like greet master, and she is always has a team of people at the welcoming table that's explaining what the beneficiary organization is for the night, smiling, welcoming people. We then have another layer of greeters, generally speaking, that says, hey, the soup's there, here's the soup, you know, handing out menus, letting people know, like, here's how you get soup. If you don't want soup yet, here's some drinks, you know, you could do that, welcome. So we have these three stations that we try and always set up, and some venues lend itself better than other venues to this kind of a setup, but we try and make sure that wherever you're going, our volunteer team is smiling at you, is making you feel like you belong there and that you're welcome. And we, generally every, we consider all of our volunteers sort of ambassadors. So it's like, if you see somebody standing alone, like maybe just go up to them and say, hi, like, who are you? Welcome. Is this your first time here? And, that's just like part of our mandate, right? And like, I'm sure sometimes we do it more effectively than others, but we try and create that atmosphere. So welcoming is really important. And the other thing is like, we try and think really positively. So this is a party about change, and it's about us coming together with a shared vision of contributing towards something bigger than ourselves. And we try and do that in a way that's framed really positively. So like, look at what we're doing. Like, this is a celebration of what this organization is doing. This is an exciting moment for us to contribute to this organization. This is a moment where we can all acknowledge that everybody in this room shares a certain set of values with us because they're here. So we just try and like, in the way that we present the organization and the way that we talk about the organization and the way that we talk about the way that we, even our chefs are interacting with everybody is very positive, very, very focused on like celebration.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And it's, and you can feel it. Do you think there's anything to do with the fact that you are not making money off of this?
Yes.
Like that kind of feeling?
Yes, I do. And I think it's, I think that's a very important insight. And I think that part of why I personally love doing this is because I feel like it's truly from a place of just doing this because I love doing it. And I think everybody else on the crew would agree because no one's getting paid to do this, right? And the pressure's off when you're not making money doing something. It feels a lot – the stakes feel lower, and yet you feel like you can do more. You know?
I just totally get that. I think certain things, if you're not going to make a lot of money in certain circumstances, it's better to make none.
Yes.
It's like a weird thing to say. But
No. Yeah. I do know what you mean.
Yeah. Is Queer Soup Night an exclusively queer space, an event? Or
I don't know.
Are allies
welcome?
I mean, you're not checking queer IDs.
I've always dreamed of making those queer IDs, but I'm not that crafty. We say all are welcome. That's part of our mission. So what I like to say is if a person who is an ally asks me if they're welcome, I say, if a queer person has invited you, you are definitely welcome. But in general, I don't say this is an exclusively queer party. I think calling it Queer Soup Night basically weeds out anybody who doesn't want to be there.
Sure.
and wouldn't feel like they should be there.
And has that kind of feeling of all are welcome, has that been the case since day one or that's evolved?
That's been the case since day one. Yeah. We've always felt that way. And, you know, we have a chapter that's getting rolling in upstate New York in the Hudson Valley. And I just had a really long conversation about this because what we were talking about is in certain places where there might not be the critical mass of queer people, like you can't say it's a queer exclusive event. First of all, that's not our mission. But second of all, that's just – that's something that doesn't make any sense, you know? You need allies to build queer community, you know, especially in places where you might not have a bazillion queers, you know?
Well, we're excited for the Hudson Valley chapter. Woo-hoo. You have a few chapters. Queer Soup Night has kind of expanded across the country. You have one in Portland, one in Florida. Is that right?
Yes.
Gainesville?
In Gainesville, yeah.
Atlanta, Chicago. I looked at the website.
Oh, nice. Yeah, good job. We updated the website.
When people reach out to you about starting a chapter, what tools do you give them?
So, good question. So we have been evolving this, right? It's been actually like a really challenging conversation, not in a way that it's like, I don't know what to do, but in a way that like, it was so organic here. We were wondering, how do you distill the information for other people to use? And side note, what pieces are indispensable to Queer Soup Night and what pieces can be shifted around based on the city and the context of that place, right? So we have come up with, we kind of created this toolkit that we share with everybody that has like the nuts and bolts of both what you have to do in order to have a Queer Soup Night, sort of our like standards of like, these are the things that can't change. And then lots and lots of information about like how much soup and how do you promote this and what will we do from, you know, we call it like QSNHQ, like what would we do here in our headquarters for you? You know, what can you expect? How can you share this with people? What's a template for like sharing like this experience with other people? And it's evolving. We are changing it and adding to it all the time as we learn. And as we work with these new chapters, we keep soliciting feedback. What things are missing here? And as they ask us questions, we've been adding it to our document. We also have a budget, you know, spreadsheet that you can use to, you know, insert your own financials. And I get on the phone a lot. I'm on the phone a lot.
That business school education is paying off.
I don't know.
But it's interesting, too, because I'm sure Queer Soup Night isn't, you know, it's not a rubber stamp. It depends where you are. And just as you said, the difference between kind of the Brooklyn kind of experience you're hosting versus one just a couple hours away in the Hudson Valley where I live, like the dynamics are really different. You know, the community is different. So, you know, the soup has to kind of adjust.
Yeah. No, it does.
What's been the most popular soup? Which one have people just gone crazy over?
I don't know. There's so many. I mean, I would say like the most surprising thing to us was that we kind of thought queers were vegetarians and they're just not. Like, it's not just true. The meat soup always sells out first.
Right.
Meat soup will always sell out first. And it is just, it's really a funny phenomenon. So I learned that pretty early, but like I still think it's funny. Although we always, you know, obviously we have all dietary restrictions served, but yeah, that's something. I mean, there's so many soups.
That's so funny. Do you think it's like the kind of paleo keto phenomenon?
No, it's not anything. It's like people are like, oh my God, I'm cold and I want to eat, like, you know, beef stew right now because
I will have
awesome.
The chicken soup. Yeah. Totally. Do you personally have a favorite soup, or is that the worst question in the world?
You know people always ask you about favorites and you're like, I don't want to pick favorites, like picking my favorite child. But again, broth with stuff in it. You know, I had last night, I was not feeling so well. So I made, I made matzo ball soup. I had a lot of awesome tricked out stuff to throw in there. But like I made some matzo ball soup with this like basically this goose meat that I had left over from an event. And I like rolled in the goose meat into the matzo balls
itself. Did you
do itself.
The goose fat in the matzo ball?
I have a ton of goose fat frozen in the freezer, but I did not get it together in time to get that into the matzo balls, but that would have been the most delicious thing.
Can we have a two-second matzo ball sidebar?
Yes.
Okay, so I don't know if this is something you've done before, but I did – I'm going to plug my last cookbook.
Oh, my gosh.
Because I did my matzo ball recipe, and I take the schmaltz, I take the chicken fat from the soup.
Yep.
I melt it in a frying pan.
Yes.
And then I put my matzo meal in there, and I toast it first, and then I let it cool and mix it with the eggs and stuff. Has this
that
ever been something you've done?
That is a best-selling cookbook right there.
It's so good.
I've never heard of that. It's
like
brilliant.
It tastes like, you know, the difference between toasted bread and just bread. It's so good.
You toast your matzo meal in the chicken fat from the soup.
It's all there. Anyway, I'm just throwing that out there as a PSA.
100% going to do that next
time. I wanted to share that.
Thank you.
Yes,
thank you
of
for
course.
That sounds so good.
All right. My last question about queer soup night before we talk about gefilteria. Have there been many romances blossomed at queer soup night?
You know, I'm going to just put it out there right now. If you have had a romance from queer soup night, I really hope you will call us and tell us this because I don't know about it.
I bet.
And I know there have been friendships. Because we have been told about the friendships were like people have told us, but I know there's been dates, which does not mean that there's been romances. I don't know about any of the romances. So, you know, this is my call to action to please contact me at queersoupnight@gmail.com if you have met your sweetheart at Queer Soup Night.
I feel like there could be a whole matchmaking.
I'm so into it.
Right?
I really want to know about that. I've been talking about it all the time, and I have nothing.
I mean, what a great place to meet your person.
It's so cute.
Or people, whatever you're into.
Yeah. It's super cute.
Gefilteria.
Yes.
It does so many things.
So many
classes,
things.
Classes, cookbook. You make gefilte fish.
Yes.
How do you define it? It's a company?
Yeah. So we say it's so funny because it's evolved over time. You know, when we first started, we were very much about the product business. And so we still manufacture gefilte fish. I don't know when this is going to come out, but it's probably available in a store near you for Passover. And we were all about the products. And so we were very much a company. And these days, we'll often use the word we're a food venture because we find that's a little bit more of an expansive term. Mm-hmm. So we'll say that we are a food venture based in Brooklyn, dedicated to exploring old world Jewish foods and reimagining old world Jewish foods. But we are a company. We're not a nonprofit. And I think that that's been significant. We do a million different things.
And who's we?
I work with my business partner, Jeffrey Yaskowitz.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Where do you guys make the gefilte fish when you're doing that part of it?
We make it in a kosher fish facility in New Jersey, actually.
New Jersey.
Yeah.
Across the river.
It's right across the river, mostly because we have kosher certification. So it's really important to keep the product kosher for our audience.
Sure.
And there are only so many places you can actually do that.
I mean, if you're going to go in the gefilte fish business, all in.
We have learned that our crowd does care about that. And also, side note, kosher – people really care more about kosher during Passover than any other time of year. So there's a particular level of fervor. So we just want to meet the needs of the customer.
Yeah.
You know?
And you say the company, the food venture, has evolved over time. How would you describe what inspired it in the first place?
You know, the background of it is that the company's been around since 2011, 2012. But before we began, I was working in the food world and Jeffrey, my business partner, was working in the food world separately. And he and I crossed paths and realized that we had this mutual love of Ashkenazi Jewish food, you know, the food of Jews of Eastern Europe, which is mostly what people in the United States think of as Jewish food, even though it is only one type of Jewish food, because the majority of Jews in the United States are Eastern European in background and eat these foods. So matzo balls and knishes and, you know, brisket. And we had discovered, I love this food. Oh my God, it's so good. But everyone we knew around us in the food world was sort of talking smack about this food and saying, oh, you know, it's old school. It's grandma food. It's brown. It's heavy. We're done with it. It's boring. And we saw chefs all around us going back to their roots and like reimagining their roots food. So it's like, you know, you'd see somebody going back to Italy and like discovering how to make cheese the old fashioned way and then bringing it to Brooklyn at some smorgasburg or something. But we didn't see anybody doing anything like that with Jewish food. We actually, instead were seeing Jewish institutions closing. So delis were closing at a very rapid rate. This is around 2006, 2007, 2008. A generation of older folks was also dying, right? So a lot of the people that kind of held the secrets to these foods were no longer with us. Or, you know, in the case of, for example, my grandmother, she was sort of like, I'm done. I don't want to make this. You know, like I was the youngest grandchild. I never had her blintzes that were very famous or her, you know, her pound cake or things like that. So Jeffrey and I got together and we started saying like, you know, we should do something about this. This is like totally bumming us out. It's like actually like a problem. Because when this food is done well, it's really good, but people don't know that because all they've had is like a filter fish in a jar or a packaged whatever, or their grandmother never gave them the recipe, so they don't feel any sort of empowerment to make it. And so we felt very, at a certain point, very activated, like we needed to do something. And we kind of joked, like, wouldn't it be funny if there was a place called the Gefilteria and you sort of like, you know, we made artisan, handmade, sustainable gefilte fish. And then we did that.
You did it. You lived it.
It's still a great story to me, even though I lived it. It's hilarious to me. I laugh every time.
I am wondering, also as a gay Jewish woman who has a whole background of Ashkenazi food and, you know,
totally.
Life in New York and all these things we have in common, I'm curious how you kind of navigate the intersection of these two communities we're talking about, the sort of queer soup night community, the kind of Jewish food community. Is there much overlap between them in your life?
Well, I'd love to answer this question, but I want to hear your answer too, Julia. I want you to answer it too.
I feel like I think about, I bring both those parts of myself. I'm both those things, mm-hmm. So I can't really separate them. And I bring both of them into my work and especially into my cookbooks. Like,
yeah.
I write a lot about the Jewish foods I grew up on. All the foods you just described are like my favorite things. I think it's really important to write them down. Otherwise, we lose them.
Yep.
To make them look just as beautiful and, you know, enticing as everything else. I also write a lot about cooking for my wife and, you know, cooking for our community. So it's like that stuff comes in, both those things come into my work a lot. But I don't think I'm actively creating the kind of spaces and experiences you are. So I'm curious, like, do you get a lot of queer Jewish people at Queer Soup Night? Do you get a lot of queer people at your Gefilteria events? Like, is there much community overlap?
You know, until recently, there wasn't any mm-hmm. overlap, to be honest. Until I started doing Queer Soup Night, I was not doing any queer stuff other than living my life and going to queer parties and hanging
just
out with
being
my friends.
Yourself. Yeah.
It was not, I was never involved other than on a like fun time level or a personal level. With being queer, my outward-facing identity was much more Jewishly oriented. Mm. I never hid it. I was never like, oh, I'm in the closet. You know, I would never say something that wasn't true in front of a Jewish audience or, you know, but it was never part of the story.
Mm. Interesting.
Because it wasn't part of the story. I work with, a cisgendered straight man 5 days a week. You know what I mean? And he's, you know, a feminist and queer-friendly and all these things, but that just wasn't part of our connection, you know what I mean? I never felt like anything was lacking, to be honest, because I always felt like I always felt really excited about my professional life getting to be one thing and my personal life getting to be a little bit separate. I think that was like something I also held a little sacred. Doing Queer Soup Night has been this really fun way of putting out another part of my identity much more publicly. It sometimes feels risky and weird, even though I'm not like worried about a backlash so much as like, I actually don't necessarily know where these things intersect. And like, I could say something about being an outsider, being a minority, you know, as a Jew in a Christian country or a queer in a straight country, mm-hmm. but it's like, I don't actually feel that way. I live in New York City. Like, I feel like this is like the ground zero, number one place to be like both of those identities, a queer and a Jew in the world.
Yeah, where you're the majority.
I feel like super stoked. So I don't feel a lot of compulsion to cross over. I'm sure there's a lot of gay Jews who come to Queer Soup Night. I'm sure that there's queers who have bought the Gefilte Manifesto or love our Gefilte fish. And I love when I hear about that, but I haven't yet figured, like, it hasn't been yet a natural, like, oh, these things overlap.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's not a Venn diagram so much for me. And not in a, it does not feel constraining. Maybe one day it would.
Yeah. No, yeah. It's
a fair question.
Need to
it's
be.
A good question. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there's something to me about Queer Soup Night that, I know it's not a religious undertaking whatsoever, but there's something about the space you're creating that feels to me, just personally, there's something kind of sacred about it. And there's something almost like the Sabbath to it. Like, we're going to take this time to just pause and eat. And in this way that's not, you know, religious or off putting or exclusive to anyone, but just this kind of like taking the time to be with a community is a really special thing, and you're doing it.
I appreciate that so much. That's so, so, you know, touching. Actually, I've never thought about that. And, you know, the thing that it brings to mind for me is that I think, you know, when you're in the food world, you meet people who are in it for many different reasons, right? And like, some people are in it because they love the stories that food tells, right? Some people are in it because they just love the craft, right? I meet a lot of people, like, they want to make the best bread. They want to like go deep into craft, right? Some people are in it because of what it, not just stories, but also like what it says about our culture, right? So people are really interested in like the anthropological something behind it. For me, I have always felt like the reason that food has been intriguing to me is because of its power to gather people, and not just around a table, but even in like larger ways. One of the reasons that I think I've always loved doing Jewish food is specifically learning about rituals we have around food that bring us together at these times of year. And if you go and you study history, there's so many interesting things. Like one of our favorite stories is about how in October in the shtetl, in these small towns in Eastern Europe, people would essentially harvest the cabbage and everybody in town was making their sauerkraut at the same time. And they would like bring in workers and, you know, they'd wash their feet and like step on the sauerkraut. And this was like, this was the way that town smelled for a month, right? And that's the kind of thing I love, not because of just the story it tells. I think that's very interesting. But like what I love is like, what did it feel like to be in that town when everyone's stomping on the cabbage, right? And it's like, that's the kind of thing I love. So Queer Soup Night has been this like awesome way to bring this to life beyond just like, oh, I have people over for dinner or, you know, we're making a meal at a cooking class for Gefilteria and it's very special. But this is like a much more massive scale of doing that. And we're doing it. We also have like a reason and a purpose to be there. There's something like really meaningful. So you're right. There is something like a little extra, a little special. So that's been always my motivation for food. I've never been a great prep cook because I don't want to be alone in the kitchen chopping vegetables for hours. You know, sure, that's like a peaceful thing to do for a couple hours. But, you know, at hour four, I'm done. I'm going to go crazy. I'm going to lose my mind. And I don't want to like be doing that. Like I've always wanted to like work the line. So at least you can see the people out there and feel the energy of them coming through the kitchen, you know? And so Queer Soup Night is kind of that on a bigger scale. And it feels really good.
Yeah. We should stomp some cabbage sometime.
Oh my God. I'm going to set it up one day. People do it in Poland still.
And it's cool too, because when you hear that story, it's so clear that, you know, the particulars of that story, but then also how universal that is. You know, women making kimchi in Korea is the same thing.
Or you know, people stomping on grapes in France for wine. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And the collective power of doing it as a community.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's yes.
Awesome.
Yes.
You do such cool things. Thank you for sharing more about them.
Thank you.
That's awesome. Can I ask you one last question that
yeah.
I just love to ask everyone? I think I probably know the answer because you sort of already answered it. But what was your favorite food when you were growing up?
Well, I did answer it, and it was definitely soup.
In a thermos.
Soup
prefer
in a thermos.
Prefer it to go or prefer it at home?
Ah, you know, whatever. Soup is whatever. Wherever you're going to give it to me, I'd be happy. I'm trying to think if there was a favorite soup. You know, I will say this. I have a very distinctive memory of the first soup that I made. At some point on a Hanukkah at age God knows what, I was given a cookbook, my first cookbook. It was some Betty Crocker kids cookbook. I think it still exists somewhere in my parents' house. And it was this funny cookbook with these sort of like vintagey, like now you look at it and you're like, these kids are wearing ridiculous clothes and like this is so funny. It's like these pictures of kids. But they had some soup and it was like canned tomatoes and like frozen peas and some noodles, but it's like, and some broth. I mean, it was really an assembly kind of soup. Obviously, it was for like a seven-year-old to make. But I remember loving that soup, this like tomato-based sort of like pseudo-kid version of a minestrone kind of soup. And I really remember that soup. So that's got to, you know, it's on the list.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Thanks.
Do you have a favorite vessel you eat soup out of? Is there like a special bowl?
Oh, I'll show you.
Or
yes.
A special mug or something? I'm so curious.
We brought back, my girlfriend and I brought back from Mexico this past summer these green bowls. And I'll show you the bowls.
Okay.
I like a wide bowl. Uh-huh. You know, I like a wide open bowl. I do not like something too narrow for soup. I'll do it, but. And what was funny is we had this day and we like go to this, you know, we take these crazy buses up some hill to this village where they sell apparently this beautiful green glazed pottery. And, you know, we go up there and we buy all this stuff. And I'm saying, Shira, how are we going to get this stuff back? This is crazy. Like, this is not, doesn't, I can't imagine. How are we going to carry this stuff back? We were going on a tiny plane. Like, it was crazy. She's like, no, we're going to do this totally fine. And you know what? I'm so glad we brought back those bowls because they were totally worth the, like, annoyance.
Amazing.
So, yeah.
I can't wait to see them. Awesome. All right. Thank you so
much. Thank you.
Before we get to our listeners' questions, a quick word about OXO, who helped make this episode possible. Why do I have so many OXO tools in my kitchen? Because I trust them. They help make my work as a cookbook author dependable and accurate, and they help make my time as a home cook more relaxed. I appreciate OXO's commitment to make every day better, every day. They approach their tools just like I approach my recipes. They notice things and solve problems and see opportunities to improve the process all of the time, like their pop containers that are stackable and space efficient. You can see exactly what's inside, you can trust that the seal is airtight, and the corners are designed for easy pouring. They're leftovers' best friend. Thanks, OXO, for supporting Keep Calm and Cook On. Want to check out OXO's products? Just head over to OXO.com. That's OXO.com. And now it's time for listeners' questions. If you have a question for me, just send me a DM on Instagram at Tertian or drop an email to keepcalmandcookonpodcast@gmail.com. One word, no punctuation. And Grace is here to ask the questions, the final questions for the first season of Keep Calm and Cook On. Grace, what are we going to talk about when this is done?
The same stuff we always talk about. Congratulations on your first season, Julia.
Thanks, Grace. Thanks for being a part of it.
Okay, your first question comes from Cardamom and Tea on Instagram, who is asking a question that you get asked a lot, which is, what do you cook when you don't feel like cooking?
So for me, it's often not so much that I don't feel like cooking, it's more that I don't want to wash a lot of dishes. In those moments, I like something that uses one nonstick pan, maybe a cast iron pan, just something that's really easy to clean up afterwards. I can make my whole meal in that pan. So I'm thinking like a big omelet filled with defrosted frozen spinach, which requires no cleaning or chopping, some cheese in there, maybe some toast on the side, or a quick stir fry, maybe an egg scrambled directly into it. One pan, super easy.
On a similar note, Salty123 asks, how do you maintain inspiration for cooking despite work and life interruptions?
So I'm really lucky because cooking is a big part of my life and my work. But sometimes I get stuck in a bit of a rut, and the best way I know how to get out of it is to cook with other people. Sometimes it's planning a meal with friends and cooking together, just getting more people in the kitchen, having some fun. And more often than not, for me, it's volunteering with a group of people to cook for our community, which Grace and I do once a week. That weekly shift, it fuels me. And I think part of it is because I'm always having to come up with something to cook based on what's available. I think it's much easier to be creative when you're working with some sort of restriction. Like if you told me I could make anything in the world for dinner, I just draw a blank. But if it has to be within some parameter, I all of a sudden feel really creative and inspired.
Speaking of that, Chloe Collette is curious, what is the best way to cook when vegans come over and they're gluten-free too?
This is such a great example of what I was just talking about. So when you have guests who have different dietary restrictions or preferences than you, I say embrace it. Make a meal that everyone can enjoy because no one likes to be an exception. For these restrictions, I would say go with a type of cooking that naturally leans vegan and gluten-free. Maybe a big kind of Korean spread of kimchi and rice and other cooked vegetables. You can do some tofu, put out a big platter of lettuce to wrap everything up, gochujang, the fermented chili paste that is so part of everything in Korean cooking. You can dot that on everything. Or do like a South Indian meal of rice and lentils, maybe a simple soup like tomato with some tamarind in it. You know, really find cuisines that are kind of naturally vegan and gluten-free and celebrate them.
Your next question comes from Springsley on Instagram, who says that aquafaba is their new favorite repurposable ingredient. Do you have any other low-waste hacks you could share?
So for anyone who doesn't know, aquafaba is this pretty amazing thing. It's the all the liquid left after you cook chickpeas. And if you whip it, it basically mimics meringue. It mimics egg whites. So you can make kind of vegan meringue or thicken things like mayonnaise and stuff without using any eggs. So any other low waste hacks to share? I love using pickle brine. After I finish a jar of pickles, which I do often because I love pickles, that brine is great to put some, chicken that's on the bone or pork chops in, brine them for a few hours before you cook them. You can also brine other vegetables in the leftover brine, slice some carrots or more cucumbers, something like that. Another thing that is similar is to use kimchi juice. The juice that kimchi gets packed in is just as valuable as the kimchi itself. It is full of flavor. And my favorite, like no work, easiest dressing ever is to mix equal parts kimchi juice and mayonnaise. You whisk those together. It is the best. You can put that on chopped vegetables. You can dip like fritters into it. It's just the best thing. And definitely do not pour that down the drain.
And if you've got vegans over, mix it with veganaise. It's our favorite go-to thing.
Bam. Thank you, Grace, so much for asking the questions. It's been so fun to have you as part of Keep Calm and Cook On.
Thanks for having me. Congrats on your first season.
Thank you. And if you have a question for me for future season, because there will be more, you can send a DM to me on Instagram at Tertian or drop an email to keepcalmandcookonpodcast@gmail.com. I love hearing from you, and I really appreciate everyone who wrote in. Before I head out, a quick shout out to the Third Wave Fund, a group that Liz introduced me to. For 20 years, the Third Wave Fund has been a leader in gender justice, a movement to end patriarchy, transphobia, homophobia, and misogyny. The Third Wave Fund is the only activist fund led by and for women of color, intersex, queer, and trans folks under 35 years old in the U.S. The funds they raise go towards providing tools and resources for young women, queer, and trans youth of color to lead powerful movements and to ensure that they have a seat at the table. To learn more about them and to support them, head to thirdwavefund.org. Thanks for tuning into this episode of Keep Calm and Cook On. If you're enjoying the show, please take a moment to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And take a minute to rate and review the show. It really makes a difference to help others find it. And because nothing is more powerful than word of mouth, please let a friend or family member know about the show. I am so glad to have you all in my community, and I appreciate that you welcome me into yours. For more information about me and my work, head over to juliatertian.com. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Tertian. Thanks again to OXO for making this episode possible. OXO makes many of the kitchen tools that I trust the most. To find out more about OXO and their products, head over to OXO.com. That's OXO.com. I'm Julia Tertian, and I'll catch you next time. Until then, take care.